good morning. I would like to officially welcome you to NERCOMP's 2013 annual conference and to the beautiful city of Providence. My name is Kara Bellotta. I'm the chair of this year's conference, and it really is my sincerest pleasure to welcome you here this morning. I grew up here in Rhode Island, and so I always hold a special place in my heart for Rhode Island. So we have some other important attendees who aren't here in the room with us. So if everybody can do me a favor and turn around in your seats and wave good morning to our online audience. Big waves, lots of waves. You can all wave, come on. Good morning. Okay, so a big good morning to our online conference. We have our online control room on the other side of the convention center, but we want to make sure and welcome them here to our keynote address as well. So I want to encourage all of you to think about improvising your future as you partake in the wonderful conference that we have planned ahead for you. So you're going to notice a lot of folks, I'm sure you've already noticed, in red t-shirts. Those folks are here to help. Please feel free to ask them any questions. They will do their very best to answer the questions. And if they don't know the answer, they'll help you find someone who does know the answer. So please use them as a resource. We have a ton in store for this year's conference. Over 50 track sessions, 12 roundtable lunchtime discussions at lunch today, 50-plus companies represented in the exhibit hall that we're all going to visit in a few moments, including the return of NERCOMP Central, which will be in the back of the exhibit hall like we were last year, so please swing by there to visit us. Tomorrow afternoon, we have 12 poster sessions, and I could really go on and on and on for hours, but you don't really want to hear me speak for hours about all of that. So our face-to-face program, we have more than 500 individuals registered between today and tomorrow, representing 29 states and 4 countries, which I think is fairly impressive. Yeah. On our online conference, we have 60 registered participants. We estimate that because folks participate in teams, we estimate that probably represents about 125 actual attendees on our online conference side, which shows some excellent growth from last year. So this being our second year of the online conference, we're excited to continue growth in that area. And representing 22 different institutions in the online conference, 14 states and Canada as well. So you might notice this red chair, and you'll see a lot of this red chair as you sort of work your way through the conference. NERCOMP is joining the Sit With Me campaign, which focuses on recognizing and inspiring women in information technology. And everyone is encouraged to visit the red chair. It's going to leave here and go to NERCOMP Central in the exhibit hall. Everyone is encouraged to come take a seat in the chair and have your photo taken to demonstrate your support and being a part of the campaign. The idea that sometimes you have to sit in order to take a stand. In addition, for our online audience, we've designed a special panel for tomorrow morning of speakers to talk a little bit about the Sit With Me campaign and how they feel about women in IT. So I'm going to take a few moments now to offer thanks to the many individuals without whom this conference would not be possible. So first, we have an amazing team of folks from EDUCAUSE, some of whom are in the room with us right now, and some of whom are running around doing a zillion other things. And they operate like a well-oiled machine, and we're always there to answer my crazy questions as we continue through this process. And so a special thanks to Gretchen and all of her exemplary staff for all of their help in planning. I want to take a moment to recognize the NERCOMP board. Can you stand, please? And so these folks work tirelessly all year long to ensure that NERCOMP continues to be an amazing organization. So thank you to all of you. It's been a pleasure. And my program committee, if you are in the audience, can you stand up for me as well? Thank you. So all of those folks, you can say thank you to them. They're responsible for developing our program and for ensuring that it's filled with amazing content. And we really, truly could not have done it without their efforts. And last, but certainly not least, I need to thank my vice chair, Don Thistle, who has been marvelously supportive and willing to help with every aspect for the almost 11 months that we've been planning this conference. So thank you to Don, and I have full confidence that you do an amazing next job next year as our chair. I'd like to say thank you to today's general session sponsor, Acquia. They have a table in the registration lobby, kind of right outside when you walk out, and you should definitely stop by there to learn more about Acquia as a company and to grab some swag that I see the board is already having fun with over here that will surely make you smile. In addition, when we leave here, you want to make sure to visit the exhibit hall, both today and tomorrow. 59 exhibitors offering technology solutions for higher education. And you can view the exhibitor directory and the solutions provided in the back of the print program that was handed to you when you registered. And you want to make sure that you grab one of these sheets from the tote stuffing area. You want to carry this around the exhibit hall with you and get stamps for each of the vendors. Once you have your, there are details on how many stamps you need, at least 15. Once you have 15 stamps, you want to turn this into NERCOMP Central. The benefit there is you'll be entered into a drawing and you could win a free registration to NERCOMP 2014, which is always, always exciting. You must be present to win, and the drawing is going to happen tomorrow afternoon at 1:30 for that free registration. So I'd like to introduce my Vice Chair, Don Thistle, who's going to introduce Frank.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kara. Again, I'm Dawn Thistle, and I'm the Executive Director of IT at Assumption College, and it's been my pleasure to work on the program committee this year as Vice Chair. Back in August, the program committee got together, and one of the things that we do at this meeting every year is brainstorm ideas for our theme and for our keynote speakers. And someone during that session, and I can't remember who it was, mentioned the book Yes to the Mess. And I thought, as a musician myself, that it would be really interesting to read about Yes to the Mess, which is, the rest of the title is Yes to the Mess, Surprising Leadership Lessons from Jazz. And that was just too enticing to me. So I read the book and I loved it. And so as we went through the summer trying to figure out what the program was going to be, we researched Frank Barrett and decided he's got to be our keynote speaker. So we were really fortunate to get him to agree to come and speak with us today. And so now I'm going to give you his biographical information so that you know all of it, just as I do. So Dr. Barrett is Professor of Management and Global Public Policy in the Graduate School of Business and Public Policy at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. He has been a visiting scholar at Harvard Business School and has taught at a variety of organizations and institutions like the Tilburg University in the Netherlands, the Katholieke University of Leuven in Belgium, Penn State University, Case Western State Reserve University, Fielding Graduate University, and Benedictine University. He received his BA in Government and International Relations from the University of Notre Dame, his MA in English also from Notre Dame, and his PhD in Organizational Behavior from Case Western Reserve University. Frank has consulted with organizations including Harvard University, Boeing, the U.S. Navy, and Ford, among many others. Dr. Barrett has written and lectured widely on social constructionism, appreciative inquiry, organizational change, jazz improvisation, and organizational learning. As mentioned earlier, he is the author of Yes to the Mess, Surprising Leadership Lessons from Jazz, published last year by Harvard Business Review Press. He is co-author with Ron Fry of Appreciative Inquiry, A Positive Approach to Building Cooperative Capacity. He is also co-editor of Appreciative Inquiry and Organizational Transformation, published by Greenwood Books. His articles on metaphor, masculinity, improvisation, organizational change, and organizational development have appeared in journals such as the Journal of Applied Behavioral Science, Human Relations, Organization Science, and Organizational Dynamics, as well as numerous book chapters. I could go on. There's a long, long list of other accomplishments. Last but not least, he is also an active jazz pianist. In addition to leading his own trios and quartets, he has traveled extensively in the United States, England, and Mexico with the Tommy Dorsey Orchestra. So we have that to look forward to. And I believe that Dr. Barrett will have some copies of his books available after this session, so if anyone is interested, please see him. And we have a little incentive for those of you who might have questions. The first person to get to ask a question will get a free copy of Dr. Barrett's book. With that, I would like to welcome Dr. Frank Barrett.
Thank you. Thank you very much. What time do I finish? I get the book. Just kidding. First question. Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm originally from Cleveland, Ohio. I live in California now, but originally from Cleveland, Ohio. So I love getting back to the East Coast. And when you live in California, we consider Cleveland the East Coast. Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Do you mind if I stand down there? Will you still be able to see me? I feel like you're just I'm a little too far away. If there's anybody in the back who can't see me, or if it's a problem with the webcast, I can change. But at any rate, again, thank you. And I love the title of your conference. Leave it to a bunch of techies to be creative like this. It's a wonderful title. And it's a topic that's close to my heart, a notion of improvisation. As Dawn mentioned, before I went to graduate school, I was a jazz musician. I played jazz piano and then decided I didn't want to live in smoky bars the rest of my life and went to graduate school. So it was and then only later realized, oh my God, I could actually study this thing that I do, this art that I love. A couple reasons why I think jazz improvisation is a good metaphor. And by the way, this is a metaphor. And metaphors are interesting because even Aristotle knew metaphor is a sign of genius, because you can take one domain and plant it onto another domain and see new possibilities. Right? So it's not a perfect metaphor, because I don't expect that all of you back in the workplace can now go back and operate your organizations like jazz bands. But it does suggest possibilities you might not have noticed before. It raises provocative questions. And when metaphors actually work in two directions, they're dynamic. So when the great poet said, "My love is like a red, red rose," it invites me to see my beloved in ways that are, you know, sweet and delicate and precious and beauty. So I see my beloved in new ways through the lens of a rose. But I also see roses differently. So what I hope is, as I talk today about some of the dynamics of jazz improvisation and what makes it work, is that you'll see some of the action in your organizations a little bit differently. I also hope you'll see jazz differently. There's a couple reasons why I think it's a useful metaphor. One is, it's a good example of what it means to think and act on the spot without perfect information. And in fact, leaders have to do that more and more nowadays, right? We need to jump in, leap in, and take action, even though we don't have perfect information. We don't have any guarantee that our actions are going to be the right ones. But we have to act anyway, given what we've got. And we often have to do it in collaboration. We have to make sense in real time with other experts in the field, and then see where our action leads. That's exactly what jazz players do. We, on the spot, take action in these ill-structured situations. And you don't have the luxury of being able to go back and say, no, let's fix that. I didn't mean to say that. Let's go back and fix it. The moment's gone. So it's real time. You're implementing and coming up with strategy simultaneously. And we find in a high-velocity world that we live in nowadays, that's a pretty a good description of a lot of leadership roles. It's also a very pragmatic view of the world, especially around learning, and that's what I want to talk about mostly. Here's the question that guides my inquiry. And I also teach for the U.S. Navy, so think about that when I say this sentence. Most of the time in organizations, we think we have to get all of our learning done so that then we can execute properly. In other words, we learn, perfect, and then execute action. And there's sometimes that that's the necessary process. I mean, when you're landing 12 planes on an aircraft carrier, you don't want to say, well, let's try and see if we can get 85% back this time. No. You got to work out all the kinks first. But that's a subset of action that really needs to fall under that rubric. Is it possible to be learning and performing simultaneously? Is it possible to execute while learning, or learning while executing? That's what I think we should think about now. I think, you know, if there's lots of ways to describe a leader's job, but one way I like to describe a leader's job is you're a facilitator of other people's learning and development. Is can you create conditions where people can learn while doing? And that's what jazz players do all the time. We are in real time executing and learning. So that's what I want to deconstruct as I go through these principles in a moment. And it's also in the context of collaboration. So it's not just you learning, but other people are also making the best guess they can at the time. So how can we maximize learning through doing? Take a minute and read that quote. And if you can, in your own mind, come up with an example. How many people have an example they can think of? None of you? I take back what I said about you techies. Nobody can think of an example like this? Were you thrown in over your head? You had to take action? Thank you. You're only one. Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate that. She should get a book for sure. I bet everybody does. Well, you're just kind of playing with me now, aren't you? Usually, those are identity-creating moments. Usually, when you look back after a moment like that, you see yourself differently than you did before. You know, when you're sort of thrown in, you feel terrified, but you have to take action anyway. There's nobody else who's going to do it except you. And you look back, you see yourself as capable of something you didn't know you were capable of before. Could you imagine doing that on purpose? Could you imagine deliberately throwing yourself in over your head in a way that you're not fully prepared just to see if you can get out of it? That's what jazz players do all the time. That's a good job description. And of course, John Dewey, the great John Dewey, knew that those are identity-creating moments. Those are the moments where learning is heightened. And I'll say something about that shortly. A word about improvisation. The word improvisation comes from the Latin word proviso. Did anybody here have to take Latin in grade school or high school? No? Recovering Catholics in the room? I had to take it. It's not a very handy language now, although during the papal election, I should be able to follow things pretty well. They're not asking me to vote. The word proviso essentially means plan. So when you put the prefix IM in front of it, it negates it, like immobile. So improviso means to act without a plan, to act spontaneously without a sense of where you're going. So musicians, we essentially act without a plan. Now, there's a difference between classical and jazz. Let me just take a second. How many in here have played or play a musical instrument? Raise your hand. Whoa. Okay, well, that's interesting. Let me just get a few. What do you play? Still? Great. What do you play?
Violin.
Great. What do you play? Flute. Now, by the way, let me say something else. I'm going to make a guess at the size of this room. I asked this question, how many have played or play a musical instrument? My guess is there's at least 15 people in the room who didn't raise your hand who have played or play a musical instrument. Okay, so let me ask it again. And if you didn't raise your hand the first time, raise it this time. Are any of you who have played or play a musical instrument that didn't raise your hand the first time I asked? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18. Isn't that interesting? I'm getting better and better at predicting the number. Now, why does that happen? Any guesses? Why would that happen? People are too shy. They think I'm going to ask them to play. Exactly. That's exactly right. Yeah, it's inevitable. Now, that voice is the enemy of improvisation. That voice that says, oh, I'm not good enough, or oh, I don't really play well enough, or oh, I hope they don't ask me to perform. That's the inner voice we're in dialogue with. And when that voice gets loud, improvisation goes down. We stay safe. So once again, let me ask, how many of you have played or play a musical instrument? Right, what do you play? You used to play clarinet? You still play? Yeah, okay. Yes, what do you play? Oh, guitar. Anybody play jazz? Any jazz players? Oh, how come you're all in the back? Wouldn't they let you sit up here? No other jazz players? What do you play? Trumpet, okay. Yeah, what do you play? Piano and organ, you still play a bit? Great. And saxophone? Oh, yeah. Guitar, piano, and flute. Okay, great. Thank you. We can get a band going before the night's over, I have a feeling. So, thank you. Next year we get. I'm surprised how many musicians are here. That's great. And okay, so the difference between classical and jazz is classical music, all the notes are written out. There's a plan. There's a concrete plan. So, but if you were playing first violin, you're going to play with Chicago Symphony, you're going to do Beethoven's third, you wouldn't say, you know, on the fourth measure here, I'm tired of this D flat, I think I'll try F sharp and see where it leads. You'd be looking for a new gig the next day, right? But in jazz, we do that all the time. Say, let's try this and see where it leads. This is a photo of the Swiss Alps. Anybody here ever hike in the Swiss Alps? Raise your hand. Yeah, I see all the jazz musicians didn't go. Only one person. Okay, well, I've hiked in the Swiss Alps myself too. And there, it's a beautiful mountain chain, very different from the Sierras that I'm used to in California. And one of the reasons it's different is it's subject to volatile changes in weather. It's a very vulnerable spot on the planet. This is a story about a group of explorers who were hiking in the Swiss Alps. And while they were gone, while they were hiking, a terrible storm came along, and they all got lost. And it looked like a very dire situation. They hung out in a cave for a little while, totally disoriented. Suddenly, one of the explorers reaches his pocket and realizes he has a map, and they're able to get out. But when they got out, they realized it was a map of the Pyrenees Mountains. Now the question is, why would that work? Why would a map of the Pyrenees help them get out? You have to interact with me now. We have to have dialogue. Pardon? They believed in it. They believed in it. What if he stopped and said, here guys, I have a map. It's a map of the Pyrenees, but it ought to work. Why else? They believed in it. Mountain's a mountain. It's going to look a little bit like a mountain. Yeah. It gives them confidence, gives them a sense of confidence. That's right. Anyway, yes? Force them into action. Exactly. I'll stay with this last point for a minute. By turning them into actors, it was turning them into learners, right? So you can imagine they're looking at the map, and comparison is the mother of insight. So they compare the map to the territory, and they see, geez, that, you know, there's a lake right here. Well, it must have dried up. We'll go around it. And as they're going around it, they're noticing new features of the terrain and seeing where it matches, where it doesn't match. Geez, but while they're looking at it, they're noticing the way the terrain lays out. So I should have cleared this path. And they became active learners, active experimenters. If they waited to get saved, they would have died. So when I do this work in organizations, on the next slide, I usually put up a map, a picture of the strategic plan of the organization, and I say, that's a map of the Pyrenees. Strategic plans are not useful because they're accurate. They're useful because they temporarily give you a sense of confidence. It's something you can believe in. It looks a little bit like a mountain in the sense it does look a little bit like the environment we're in this organization, but it turns us into active doers. We can experiment and learn as we go. Jazz musicians work with a map of the Pyrenees. These are the 8 points. Each corresponds to a chapter in the book. I won't cover them all in the interest of time. But I want to say something about point number six right now, because I fear I won't get there, and it's at the moment my favorite point. In organizations and in leadership literature, we put so much emphasis on individual leaders. We sing their praises. We turn them into gods. If a Martian were to come down and look at a bookstore at any airport, they would think that Bill Gates is a god, or Steve Jobs is some sort of a demigod, or it used to be Jack Welch or Donald Trump, as if this great individual leader. And I think we've learned to overestimate it. Maybe it's the old Western cowboy mentality, but we've sort of overemphasized, because what about good followership? How many good books are there about good followership? And the question I ask, is it possible that followership is a noble calling too? And we don't have many models of that. And jazz is a great model of followership, what good noble followership can look like. And what I mean by that is, in jazz, we call it comping. Comping. Anybody know what I mean when I say that? Thank you, jazz musicians. When I look hopelessly up like that and I ask a question, just raise your hand. Comping. What does comping mean? Yes, provide the background, provide the rhythm. Comping short for accompaniment. So if the sax player is playing a solo, where's my sax player? Over here. The sax player is playing a solo. The piano player behind them, it just listens real closely and sort of supports their thinking. So noble followership means you try to make the other person brilliant. You do everything you can to help the other person star. And you don't do it too well, or your ego gets in the way, and then you just became another soloist, and we ain't got room for two. So I think it wouldn't be great in organizations if we rewarded great followership. You know, rewarded people for helping another person become more brilliant and get credit and take leadership. So I want to mention that theme because it's, I think it's chapter 6 of my book. If I don't get there, I wanted to mention it now. So the first point, what I call mastering the art of unlearning. In jazz, jazz players do learn routines, and we call them crips, short for cripple, and we learn patterns and scales and arpeggios and phrases and riffs. But the goal of jazz is to not sound like you always sound, is to not repeat what's comfortable. Because improvisation means you're supposed to play something new and creative on the spot, and maybe like something you've never played before. So there's this notion is you try and create, you surprise yourself on the spot. You develop these routines but have to abandon them and become very suspicious of patterns. I love this quote from Miles Davis, if it sounds clean and slick, I've been doing it too long. So among jazz musicians, see if anybody, the notion is you just sort of throw yourself into the terror and make something good come of it. Anybody know who that is on the left? Oscar Peterson, very good. Give that man an A. How many books do we have to give away? Only one? Well, you two are going to have to share it. You can have chapter 1 and 2. Oscar Peterson on the left. My first idol when I was in my 20s, I loved Oscar Peterson. He's a brilliant piano player. That's who was playing when you walked in the room on the speaker system here. I was shocked in my late 20s when I discovered that among other jazz musicians, Oscar Peterson is not highly valued. He's not considered a great improviser. Why do you think that is? Any thoughts? Yeah. He plays a lot of patterns. He plays them flawlessly. He has incredibly fluid technique. Horowitz used to go and listen to him play because his technique was so good. But he sounds the same on Friday as he did on Saturday, as he did on Sunday. He plays licks and patterns that you're just sort of in his memory. So as opposed to that person on the right, who's that on the right? Sonny Rollins. Very good. Thank you. Sonny Rollins. Regarded the world's greatest living improviser. And why? Because sometimes he stinks. Because he's always trying to do stuff he's never done before. And he's sometimes brilliant and sometimes it falls flat. Quick story about him. In the early 1960s, he was already famous. He'd been playing with Miles Davis and John Coltrane and others. And he was tired of hearing himself play because he knew what he was going to do next. So he quit. He took his tenor saxophone went under the Brooklyn Bridge in New York and started playing. And every time he heard himself play something that sounded familiar, he stopped. And then he started again. And he heard himself play something familiar, he stopped until he could play something. He was playing ongoing creativity at every moment. He came out of retirement and recorded an album. And the album didn't sound like anything that had ever been recorded before. People didn't believe it was Sonny Rollins. And in fact, it got terrible reviews. It's now on everyone's list of the top 10 albums ever recorded. Who knows what the title of the album is? No, the Pent Up House is on it. That song is on it. Anybody know what the title of the album is? The Bridge. Who said that? Excellent. The title of the album is The Bridge, named after his self-transformation. When it first came out, it was not understood. And now almost everybody highly values it. A word about Oscar Peterson, whom I still, Oscar there. I heard him in a concert about a year before he died. There he is getting my autograph. He was a brilliant guy. I have a theory as to why he was playing patterns over and over again. When he was 25 years old, he was already a superstar. He played in Carnegie Hall at the age of 25 with the greats, Charlie Parker, Lester Young, etc. Here's the message I think we should think about. It's a mixed bag to be really successful too young. If you're a big hit and make it real successful too young in your life, it's harder to risk failure. That's why I tell my mom I'm such a late bloomer. There's a quote from Steve Lacy. If you just look at those words, it really typifies the way jazz players play. They're on the edge. They sort of leap into the unknown, see where it's going to lead. Great quote from Keith Jarrett about interrupting habits. He got the great pianist. How many have any albums by Keith Jarrett? Raise your hand. Okay, cool. The room's getting hipper and hipper as I speak. If he heard himself playing familiar things, he made himself stop because it was like when you are doing routines and habits, you are not fully present. It's like your routines are thinking you rather than you thinking your routines. So good jazz musicians have to work really hard at this. If you tell people that they have to give up what's been successful and what they can rely on for competence, then what really makes it work is this, what I call affirmative mindset, is say yes to the mess. This notion that no matter what junk is in front of me, I can make it work. That's what the title of the book comes from, this is that you can't predict what's going to happen. You can't. Problem solving is of limited help. You can't go back and fix what went wrong. But what you can do is say yes to the future. And I'm thinking right now about the title of your conference. That's a very optimistic title you have there. It's this notion of affirmation, is that I can somehow make sense out of all this junk that's in front of me, even if I didn't put it there. And I wish it was somebody else. I wish it was some other notes. I wish you had played something else. But this is what I got. So I'm going to demonstrate what I'm talking about. I'm going to go and play the keyboard now. I hope it's connected. I haven't actually heard it yet, so this is going to be interesting. The sound people are still here, right? Good. Let's see. Oh, wow. Are you controlling volume? You can turn it up just a little bit. Thank you. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to play through the chromatic scale, and I'll announce the note before I play it. I want you to close your eyes and pick a note. People are drawn to tones and tonality. So let me just close your eyes. Don't tell anybody what you pick. Here's a C. D flat. D. E flat. E. F. G flat. G. A flat, A, B flat, B, and C. Okay? Everybody have a note? You could turn the volume up on that just a teeny bit. That would be helpful. Yeah, okay, let me see. What note did you pick? F. Okay. All right. This is how I get my workout. F it is. I'll call it down from here. I can jump this. Okay. Did anything jiggle that shouldn't have? What note did you pick? Okay, well, hold off. What note did you pick, sir? C. Okay. Okay. Oh, anything rip? Here we go again. Oh! Okay. What note did you pick?
A.
A? Did you really, or you just picked it because you saw F and C? Okay. I'm going to walk up this time. It feels a little safer. Okay. Okay. So here's the tricky one. Sir, what note did you pick? Okay, right next to you, in this plaid shirt, right? A. Okay, I need a new note. What note did you pick? D. Okay. All right. All right, well, here we go. In theory, yes to the mess means when in improvising, you can make something happen out of any arbitrary set of junk that's in front of you if you keep trying with the mindset of affirmation. So let's practice this. We doing all right with the sound here? Here's what you picked. Actually, is anybody here a perfect pitch? So I could play any four notes, you wouldn't know, huh? Here it is. It's like a... Thank you. That was very responsive. Yeah, thank you. If everybody paid attention to me that well, I'd just let go. Not bad. It's been worse. I mean, that's not bad for a no rehearsal. So in theory, I'll just goof around like this. You should be able to use a D flat there, by the way, instead of a D. Next time somebody does this. Well, thank you. What did you notice? It got better. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. Yes, it got better. It started off, I started off, frankly, a little terrified and maybe started off tentatively. Just sort of bouncing around, jumping around, seeing what was there, trying to look at the territory. I looked back on what I did and repeated it, and suddenly it could make sense. And it's just kind of the way we behave in real life. Our life is like a lantern around which we see, we're in the woods with a lantern. We can see a little bit in front of us and a little bit behind us. I looked back on what I played, and I made a guess about what to go into the future. And each time I uttered something, a new path would show up. It's kind of like wandering around the Swiss Alps with a map of the Pyrenees. Is action reflects back on itself and creates new possibilities. Now, I joked about this, but the truth is, every time I've ever done this, I felt terrified. No matter how many, it doesn't go away. Because I know everybody's expecting something to happen, and I have no idea what could possibly come out of this, and it's just, but the worst experience I've ever had doing this, people picked four notes, and these are the four notes, and I'm not making this up. This is what they picked. No matter what happened, I could not stop myself from playing this. Well, there's a moral to that story. When you start a routine, when there's a well-worn routine and a memory, it's hard to think out of it. Like I said, it thinks you. And think about in organizations, we do that all the time. A routine gets started, and it has a mind of its own. You almost have to throw something in, a monkey wrench in there, just to see if you can turn it around so you can pay attention in new ways. And when I could not think clearly, even though it was the most familiar, it actually turned me into an idiot. Because I couldn't think outside of that structure. So sometimes a little bit of terror is a good thing. I love this quote from Peter Drucker. Take a minute and look at that. That's yes to the mess, huh? To deliberately pay attention to who we are at our best and what's working. The thing is, jazz is intense, isn't it? It's a full commitment. I say that because I know you're in the IT field, and sometimes we put so much emphasis on virtual communication, and one of the things we have to be careful not to give up is what it means to be fully, full-bodied engaged and not just have talking heads, huh? Full-bodied engagement is where risk happens. We can't get rid of risk because that's essential to learning. That's Bill Evans, a great pianist. That's full-bodied engagement. You can't tell where the piano stops and Bill Evans starts. And the great Billie Holiday. That's a full yes to the mess. Well, people think that jazz is just pulling notes out of thin air. In fact, there is a structure to jazz. And it's a minimal structure. And I say this because in organizations, we overstructure things, often because of control. We want to control outcomes, and we overstructure stuff. We structure the creativity out of it. And in jazz, there's also a structure, but it's a minimal structure that allows maximum autonomy. And the structure I'm talking about is the structure of chord changes. Chord changes in a song are these limited structures that coordinate action through time. There are these impersonal constraints that invite you to embellish and transform them, but they themselves can be the target of transformation. So I'll show you what I mean. It's actually the chord changes to a song. And I'm going to quickly write on this whiteboard the chord changes to a song, and if anybody can name this song, I'll be so impressed, and I'll give you a free book. Goes like this. People on the webcast back there, how do I look from behind here? You'd think I would have done this in advance, wouldn't you? Almost done. Okay. I'll give you a minute to look at it. Any guesses? Go ahead, what's your guess? Oh, Twinkle, Twinkle. A lot of people say that. It's got a little structure like that. That's a good guess. It's a song called All of Me. Have you ever heard that song? Any of the piano? You ever hear that before? So those are the chord changes to that song. It's a jazz standard. A lot of people play it. And that's what I mean when I say it's a minimal structure through time. So through time, that structure allows musicians to coordinate. When we get to the eighth measure, I have no idea what you're going to do, but I know you're going to orient yourself to D minor. And by the way, it's impersonal trust. So we put so much emphasis on trust and building consensus in jazz and also in organizations. Too much consensus is just as bad as not enough consensus. You don't want full agreement. You get everybody agreeing on everything, you just create a nice little groupthink for yourself. It drives out creativity. You want a little bit of battling, like the old New York Yankees when they're always fighting each other, and then they go out and kill everybody. So you know what? Just enough agreement about the right things, but lots of diversity around everything else. So don't spend so much time working on agreement. The other thing is all this stuff around trust. You know, we talk about trust in jazz. That's kind of irrelevant. Musicians often play each other they've never met. They play for the first time, or they don't particularly like each other. I mean, if you want to ruin a good jazz band, bring in an organizational development consultant and do a team building session with him. Could you imagine that, you know? Let's get all agreement at the break. Say, let's go over our vision for the next set. How do you see yourself contributing to the mission of this organization? They would kill you. They would get out of here. That's too much agreement. Let it emerge. Let's see what happens. So that's what I mean about it. So I'll just demonstrate this real quick. If I get someone to help me, sir, would you help me? Yeah. What's your name?
Jeff.
Jeff, come on up. Would you help me, please? Jeff is looking terrified. We've never met, have we, Jeff?
No.
Good to meet you. Come on up here. Thanks. Come on up. I appreciate this. I'll tell you what I want to do, Jeff. Sorry you raised your hand before, Jeff? Yeah. I know how you feel. So here's what I want to do. I'm going to play this song. I'd like you to point to the chords as I'm playing them.
Okay?
Do you know this song?
Yeah.
You do? So you won't have any trouble. Four beats for each measure. And so people can see. So I want them to be able to follow the structures that are allowing this to go on. Okay? And if you get lost, there's a bunch of people out there who will help you, because I know there's people who know how to follow this. Okay? And so what I want you to do is pay attention to these structures, and then I'll improvise on it. So here's the second verse. Starts right here. And I'll start improvising there. I tend to be a little time happy, so I'll probably start rushing about that point. Feel free to hold me back if you have an extra set of drums anywhere. Okay? Okay. We could switch roles if you want. I could. Okay. Okay. So now I'll play the chords very deliberately through so you can hear it. It'll be very explicit. And then I'm going to pull back and just play them as background and improvise on it and try and get a little riskier as I go so you can see that it's this little structure that allows all this variety to happen. Okay? You ready, Jeff? One, two, three, four, C. Second C. E7 coming up. You hear the melody? A7. Jeff, you're doing great. E minor? Okay, good. E7. Can you hear the melody in your head? In a minute, I'm going to start improvising. Not bad, eh? There's a lot of hidden talent out there, I see. Now I'm nervous. Thank you, Jeff. Well, I'll ask you what you noticed. In the interest of time, I'll just point out a couple things. There's this, I say, minimal agreement. There aren't some non-negotiables. So think about this. Translate this to your own leadership and your organization. What are the non-negotiable minimal agreements we have to have through time that we know we're going to stay loyal to? And what's everything else that needs to be let go? As long as we can continue to come back and pivot around these things. I could tell all kinds of stories in organizations where they took this seriously. And it's essential for creativity. Okay. So the notion is that give people a lot of freedom, tolerate, dissent, debate. I'm checking my watch real quick. I see I have still a few minutes here. We know that if you're going to let people go off like that, there's going to be mistakes. What do you do about mistakes? You just treat them as another group of notes. In fact, you not only do you cannot go back and fix them, you actually repeat them. In jazz, you repeat mistakes. So in retrospect, it sounds like you did it on purpose. So I'll show you what I mean. The fourth interval of this first chord is an F on a C chord. Here's a C chord. Here's an F. That sounds bad. Well, what happens if you hit that note on that chord? You just repeat it. Explore it for all it's worth. And think about in organizations how often we too often punish failure. Now, certain kinds of mistakes are intolerable. You know, failure of effort, carelessness, we can't tolerate that. But we need to be able to reward effort, especially if it's effort above on routine. And sometimes it means you have to actually reward failure. As Miles Davis said, if you're not making a mistake, it's a mistake. I used to do consulting for Boeing aircraft, and I did this workshop for them. And one night afterwards, I heard that. That's exactly what jazz musicians do. Quickly, Amy Edmondson, one of my colleagues at Harvard, did this study of nursing units, and what she found was in units where was better leadership, better culture, actually had more mistakes than others, and she thought her data was wrong. Why do you think this was? Go ahead. Yes. Exactly. What she said is when the nurses trust each other, they feel they can fail, and they end up succeeding even more. What actually happened is they studied these cultures. In these particular cultures, they're expected to report their mistakes or expected to talk about it out loud. And so it looked like they were making more mistakes, but in fact, what they were doing was learning more from mistakes. The other ones were just repressing it. Now, back in your own organizations, what this means is how do you keep a culture like this that has psychological safety? It starts with leaders. You know, I don't think it's any big secret that in hospitals, it's mostly male physicians, female nurses. That's a double whammy in terms of status. So in order for nurses to feel safe enough to speak about their errors, doctors had to go first. And they remember the moments when a male doctor, male surgeon, mind you, says in public he made a mistake and had to learn from it. You have to model this behavior yourself as a leader, because there's a lot of projection heading your way. People notice what you say, notice what you do. If you model what it is to learn from a mistake in public, it helps the learning of everyone. I'll just say quickly this point, and then I want to move to a closing. Let me check on my time. How much time do I have? Two more hours? Oh, good. Great. Usually we think now, oh, this is IT people, so I have to be careful how I say this. Excuse me, I'm doing some self-editing. Okay, let's skip this point. I'm kidding. So, I work for the Navy, and often they think to do learning, you send people out for executive education. And I remember sitting in the classroom one day, I sat in the back of the room, and this is a true story. People were sitting in the room listening, and there were 393 PowerPoint slides shown. I'm not making it up. And that was 5 days of that. That was one day. And I thought, oh, my God. And they're all taking notes. And I said to the director, you know, this is not really where learning happens. Real learning doesn't actually, you know, you should create some time offline where they can hang out and question each other and talk and let serendipity happen. And he said, we can't do that. They'll never fund us to come all the way out here to Monterey if we think that we're out having fun. Well, you can structure serendipity, as Steve Jobs so well knew. I call this become an architect for serendipity, for happy accidents, for accidental discoveries. And that's what jazz players do in jam sessions and hanging out. Steve Jobs, for example, I won't talk about Edison for the moment, but when he designed the Pixar building, there's a bunch of introverted engineers. And when they first did the design, they wanted their offices so they could play with their toys and their technology. And so you can see now why I had to edit my story, can't you? Huh? You're all hoping I don't step in it right now, aren't you? He looked at the design and he said, no way. And he made their offices all small and created these open spaces. So in the entire building, there's only one bathroom. Now, why would he do that? He wants to make sure they interact with each other. You bump into each other, you talk to each other. He didn't want these introverted geeks hanging out in their offices because that's only a limited amount of learning is going to happen there. So a great quote from him. He says, there's a temptation in our network age to think ideas can be developed by email or iChat. He says, no, it's random discussions. Creativity happens in spontaneous meetings. So if you think about that in your own departments, do you have space where people can just hang out with no agenda? You never know what's going to happen. Chance favors the prepared mind, and networks prime, they help prepare us. They help get us prepared. So I mentioned the one about soloing and supporting, creating followership as a noble calling. And I want to close with this example. And let me start by asking this. Can you think, ask a question, ask you to think about this for a moment. Think of somebody in your life who had an influence on you, maybe a teacher, maybe a leader, maybe a relative, somebody who saw your potential better than you saw yourself. Does everybody have an example of somebody? I hope you all have at least one. Okay, think of that one person for a minute. On the count of three, say their name out loud. One, two, three. Great, that was a beautiful mess. I love it. But this time, on the count of three, say that person's name out loud so the person furthest away from you in the room can hear you. Are you ready? One, two, three. That's beautiful. Now think about it for a minute. Chances are, if those names that were just uttered, if they didn't exist, chances are you wouldn't be here. Chances are they somehow made you happen. I think about this for a moment, about what it means to see somebody's potential better than they see themselves. And my example of a leader who did that brilliantly is Miles Davis. Now, Miles' personal life was a mess, but as a leader, he was brilliant. Because he did just what your mentors did. He brought together people and he saw them better than they saw themselves. I call it provocative competence. This notion that you explore the edge of comfort and then tweak it so the person has, you disrupt the person, so they have to perform in new ways beyond their comfort level. Here's what they used to do. Check this out. The band at the time in the 60s, the piano player was 24 years old. His name was Herbie Hancock. No one had heard of him then. The saxophone player was 23 years old. His name was? Wayne Shorter. Very good, Jeff. Thank you. The drummer was a 17-year-old kid. He had to get special permission to play in places that had bars. And his name was? Tony Williams. Bass player was the old man of the group, Ron Carter. He's 29. Anybody here who has jazz albums, there's a 30% chance Ron Carter's playing bass. He's the most recorded musician in jazz history. These guys had never met, never played with each other. He put them together and he said, no rehearsals. In my band, there's no rehearsals. And in fact, that band never once rehearsed. The question is, why? Don't you want to rehearse before you go play before 10,000 people? He said, no, if you rehearse, then when you're playing on the bandstand, you already know it. You're not fully present. I want you to be fully there. And so he used to do little tricks with them, what I mean by provocative competence, to make sure that they showed up in creative new ways. So they would take standard tunes, a standard song like If I Were a Bell, and this is actually on record. There's a standard song called If I Were a Bell. Maybe some of you know it. It's a Frank Lester tune from a Broadway show. It goes like this. Does that sound familiar? No? Everybody knows that song in the key of F. So Miles would be on the bandstand, and he'd go, and he had this cool voice, too, so it made it sort of mysterious. He'd say, okay, let's do If I Were a Bell. You ready? One, two, let's do this in D flat. And Herbie Hancock said, shit, I don't even think in D flat. But it's not like there's another band in back that's going to play while you get your act together. It's like you are the only one. And he said, I never had to pay so much attention in my life. He said, my ears were listening, my toes were listening, my elbow was listening. But I heard myself play things I never played before. It's like he disrupted. The provocative competence means you monitor the edge of people's competence and disrupt it just enough so that they have to show up in new ways. But disrupting isn't enough. People who disrupt or are provocative all the time are obnoxious. You have to have something else too. It has to come with love. And the love in this sense was, go ahead, keep trying. Go ahead, we'll do. Keep doing it. We'll try it again. Try it again. Just keep going. It's kind of the way our parents taught us how to speak when we were little kids. None of us spoke a perfect sentence the first time we talked. We had a lot of flubs, and we had some adult in our life, some loving adult, who just repeated back to us again and again and gave us a chance to keep trying. That's what provocative competence is. And I want to close with a quick story because it's an important historical event in the history of jazz and why I think Miles Davis is a leader, is someone who's even underappreciated now. The year was 1959. And at the time, what was being played in American jazz was bebop. Does anybody here have any bebop music at home or listen to bebop? Okay, cool. We got a couple of hip people here. Bebop, two qualities about bebop music. It's really fast, and there's lots of chord changes. So I'll show you. Here's what bebop would sound like. I'll give you an example. I played some earlier on record here, but it's this is taken from, here's a four chords. What song is that? Anybody know? I Got Rhythm. That's right. These four chords, if you memorize these four chords, you can get a job in any cocktail lounge in America. Well, anyway, I digress. So they would take four chords like this, play them real fast, and put a lot of chord changes in between. And I'll give you a touch. I can't touch their tempo, but I'll give you a sense of what it sounded like. Hard driving, right? So Miles Davis, he brings this group together, and let me tell you the names of these musicians, because they were unknown outside of the musical community. At the time, no one had heard of them. The tenor sax player was a guy named John Coltrane. The alto player was Cannonball Adderley. Bill Evans was on piano, America's answer to Debussy, the greatest jazz pianist who ever lived, in my opinion. Paul Chambers played bass. Jimmy Cobb on drums, the only person still alive. And the year was 1959, and they had been playing hard-driving bebop music like every other American jazz group. And they show up at 2 o'clock one afternoon in the studio, and Miles had written out almost on a napkin or on scrap paper, he says, okay, no chord changes. We're going to play in the D Dorian mode, and we'll do that for 16 bars. And then we'll go up a half step to the E flat Dorian mode, and we'll do that for 8 bars, then we'll come back to the D Dorian mode for 8 bars, and then we'll solo on that. Okay, who knows what the Dorian mode is? Well, neither did they. And he turned to the sound engineer, recording engineer, and he said, hit it. And they recorded everything with no rehearsal, no second takes, and everything you hear is them wandering around the Swiss Alps with a map of the Pyrenees, trying to figure out what they got, and how, making it up as they went. The Dorian mode, by the way, is built on fourths. It's an Eastern mode. Am I going to be able to play this music in a moment here?
Yeah, okay.
Thank you. So that's the Dorian mode. It sounds a little Eastern, right? So I'm going to talk through this because this particular event changed the history of Western music. It's now the highest selling jazz album of all time, and it sells 1 million copies a year. Some of you may know it. It's called, you know the name of it? Exactly, Kind of Blue. Here's a picture of it somewhere. In a moment, I'm going to put it right on. Okay, sure. So I'll talk through it, and so you can help you hear a couple things that are happening. It opens up. Bill Evans is just sort of messing around on the piano. Now think about this for a moment. If you're John Coltrane or Cannonball Adderley, you're thinking, "What the hell is this?" And you're hearing this for the first time. But you got a solo. The bass player starts this pattern, which is why I thank you for bringing the speaker so we could hear this. That's the only thing written out. So you'll hear that. And then Bill Evans answers it. He goes. When they released this album 3 months later, they didn't have a name for that song, so they named it after Bill Evans' chord changes. They called it So What? You'll hear the first solo will be Miles Davis, and he'll play these three notes, and that's it. You're just going to hear him build on these three notes. You'll hear his horn squeak a little bit. If any of you have kids taking trumpet lessons, I promise you, that trumpet teacher told them, do not sound like Miles Davis. Nobody sounded like him. He sounded so human, mostly because his mistakes are right out there and open. And he'll repeat this phrase a couple of times. And you'll listen to him just build it up as he goes and listen to the band become increasingly confident. Again, you already know more about this than they did at that moment. One thing I want to point out, on drums, Jimmy Cobb, at the beginning when the solo starts, when Miles Davis starts his first solo, Jimmy Cobb bangs the drum because in bebop, when the soloist starts, you sort of like kick him in the butt. It's like you bang the cymbal and tell him, yeah, let's go. Well, he did it on this, and he realized it sticks out like a sore thumb. This is not traditional, hard-driving, multiple-chord change bebop. And he says later, he thought, oh, man, I thought we were going to have to take it over. This is what to do. There were no retakes, so it's hanging out there, and I'll point it out to you in a moment. You'll notice at one point, Bill Evans on piano is listening so closely as he's comping that he plays the exact same phrase as the soloist. How is that possible? You'll hear John Coltrane running notes up and down the scale, trying to figure out what the hell. It's like as if he's Picasso looking at the color palette, saying, I got a blue, a red, a green. So you're literally watching people think out loud together, creating on the spot. What's your first name again? Tyler, thank you. I'm going to give this a shot. It's a very dramatic opening here, and I'll talk you through it. Let's hope nobody calls me in the middle of this. And then we can take some questions. Here it goes. Can't hear it yet. No sound? Here we go. So, a little louder. So there's Bill Evans. Thank you. Imagine you're just sitting around for the first time. Here, Paul Chambers on bass. And there's Bill Evans. Thank you, man. The horns imitate Bill Evans right here. Listen. Probably turn it down just a little. They go up a half step now to E flat, Dorian. Back down to D, Dorian. Okay, here we go. Three notes from Miles Davis, first solo. Listen to the chord symbol. Second verse. A half step to E flat, Dorian. Back down to D, Dorian. So you can hear them get more confident. I'm not going to play it all the way through in the interest of time. I recommend, highly recommend this album. How many have a copy of this album already? Raise your hand. Oh my God, you're so hip. So you see what I mean about provocative competence. What did Miles do? He monitored the edge of their competence. He did not ask for consensus. You know, leaders are supposed to get consensus. No, they were not comfortable. He disrupted it just enough, right, and gave him a chance to try and try again so that people could start to perform in new ways. And the first step is he saw their potential better than they saw themselves. As a result, he changed the history of jazz, actually changed the history of Western music. Rock and roll now uses modes like this. Let me check on time. Do we have time for questions or time for a few questions? I think you should step to the microphone, probably. Is that right? I'll come down, too.
Thank you. Okay, now I can sit down. I fully support the style of management, but most of us work for very finely tuned bureaucracies. How do you encourage it from the top down?
Yeah. Right. Well, couple things. It's if you look a little closer, what improvisation is and what it means and how it happens is it's happening in all organizations all the time, even in bureaucracies. It's just people hide it. So one thing you can do is just be open about it. In Toyota, a manufacturing company, has on their assembly line. You would think this is the one place where we have high reliability, mechanistic organizing, drive out improvisation. But on the assembly line, people are expected to do ongoing experimentation. The job of the foreman is to help the person online learn from experimenting during work at the time. So the reason for bureaucracies is to guarantee some kind of outcome. You want some sort of reliable performance. I think once we realize you can still get reliable performance if you also encourage experimentation and learning while doing. So I understand that. We probably have a lot more freedom at our disposal than we know. And I think I understand your boss isn't in the room, so we can't influence him. But you have people who work with you. So you can create this kind of culture around you. That's my first thought. I'm sure there's other people have other ideas about it, but I hope that's helpful. The last chapter that you from the book you just got has sets of tools you can use. Other comments, questions?
So my question is, sometimes people are reticent to go back and try something that they failed the first time. And
yes.
a lot of what you talked about was sort of perfecting on something that didn't quite go so well. It gets better as you do it over time. So you often hear, well, we tried that 5 years ago, 10 years ago, whatever it was. It didn't work.
Right.
So how do you kind of approach that challenge?
Yeah, good question. One thing is I would change the story. Change the story we tell about a failure. Because chances are maybe there was a project you tried and maybe it did fail, but chances are a bunch of other things happened too. Like people who usually didn't collaborate might have collaborated on this thing. Maybe they learned something that they applied to something else. I mean, how many people in this room have an iPad? Okay, the iPad is here because of a massive failure that Apple made. Apple Newton. Anybody ever have an Apple Newton, one of the first PDAs? By almost all accounts, it was a massive failure. Some people did lose their jobs, but what they learned from developing the Newton is how they were able to develop the iPad. So we could change the story we tell. It's too easy to just write off an experience, oh, that was, we tried that as a mistake, we're not going to do it again. So one thing you could do is inquire, be curious about, well, what else happened during that time? What else did we learn from that effort? That's one first thought. Yes, do you want to come to the microphone or do you want to yell it out loud? Okay. Technical competence. So you're saying one of the reasons they were able to improvise well and kind of bloom and whatnot is they were technically competent. That's true. Absolutely true. However, that can also be a crutch or an excuse to say, I can't do it with these people because they're not skilled enough. If only I had people, if only I had a better group to work with. If only I had Cannonball Adderley and Alto Sax working for me. That's, in a way, that's an escape because that's a way of saying no. Saying yes to the mess means there's potential, untapped potential there somewhere. Maybe they can't do X, Y, Z as well as we'd like, but too easily we write people off, because we think we know their capacity. And it means, I think, great leadership. I like the quote from Peter Drucker earlier, notice who people are at their best and magnify their strengths so that their weaknesses become less powerful, less relevant. But you're right. I mean, of course that's true. But my other comeback to that is we are all, in some ways, innately, inherently geniuses. The fact that we learn to speak a language from the time as little kids is an incredible thing. Can you imagine that? That two human beings who never met can carry on a conversation with sentences, and you look at me like I'm making sense, so I assume. The fact that we can learn a language and learn a skill like this is an incredible human accomplishment. People are usually capable of high potential, more so than than they see themselves. Do I have a closing comment, or is this it? Can I have one more closing comment? Or
you can have one more.
Are you following me around because you have a crush on me, or is this just?
We can discuss that later.
Okay, thanks. Thank you. Okay, now I'm all flushed and nervous. All right, I'll close with it because this your question made me. Now I have a question for you now. Go think back to your workplaces. Think of one person in your workplace whose potential you see better than they see themselves. Everybody pick somebody. This is going to take a little bit longer, right? Because we're all solipsist narcissists. Most of them, I shouldn't speak for you. I'll just speak for myself. But think about somebody back at the workplace whose potential you see better than they see themselves. On the count of three, say their name out loud so that the person farthest away from you in the room can hear it. One, two, three. Wow. So just think about that for a minute. Look how lucky those people are. Because you're going to change their life. Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.